the radials or 16 ground plane radios without the rubber, and you try to measure the difference in performance. When you put your own meter on that ground plane radial system by way of one lead there and the other lead of the copper pipes in your house, and you measure the impedance to the earth with a DC meter, yes, you will see a difference. RF-wise, I think the difference is going to be very minor, is my belief. So those are what I think some of your questions might be, Steve. And so fill me in on what your real question is. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, you answered it. So whether or not the ground radios are insulated really just doesn't matter. You coat them for corrosion resistance, but that's about it. All right, that's fair enough. Because I was thinking, you know, like you said, I've heard you say a few times about, you know, the ground plane being, you know, you want it to be an infinite conductor, you know, in all directions. So to me, common sense would say that, you know, perhaps having it uninsulated where now you can, you know, bring the earth in to fill in the space between the radials would make a difference. But I guess at RF it doesn't. So, fair enough. Thank you for answering the question. KD2HUC, back to net.
Is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system?
A way of making the ground more conductive. I think there are broadcast stations that lay down a wire lath, a wire mat of horizontal and vertical wires, sometimes welded together at the joints, and sometimes they put conductive salts into that soil to make the soil more conductive. And this can have all kinds of side effects as far as the drainage of these conductive materials going into the water table as the rain takes place. But you could make that soil more conductive and get a little bit more efficiency out of it. I don't recommend we amateurs do that. Broadcast stations, I think I've read stories of where they have done that on some occasions. A much better approach is just to lay down more wires and make the wires out of something that's less corrosive and more surviving of the acids that are in the soil. So, now, because the dipole is a standing wave structure, because the current is going to be flowing between the left side and the right side, and it's going to bounce back and forth at least 10 times before it gets radiated. In the case of a single piece of wire, one half wavelength long, with no gap in the center, fed from the open end. Let me drop it. That is an extremely high performance antenna. The infinite sheet of metal, in that if you build a vertical half wavelength single strand piece of wire, as long as you've got a high enough tree or high enough tower to mount this thing, and you feed it from the bottom, you've got one slight disadvantage. Feeding it from the open end, you're going to be feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance. And so you need a step-up device, an L network, an LC network to step up the impedance and still create the resonance, if you know what I mean. But that you no longer need a zillion ground plane radials. Just one simple spike in the ground because you're feeding a 2,000 ohm structure is more than good enough. And that might be giving you more performance than you would get with 32 ground plane radials. You're getting more performance for a bunch of reasons. That infinite sheet of metal is now a quarter wavelength above the ground, in theory, on this half wavelength vertical piece of wire. You're feeding a very high impedance. Your phase center of your antenna is higher up above the ground. And so if you've got the tower to mount this thing, that's a very high performance antenna and a lot easier to construct, even in portable locations. As long as there's a tall enough tree nearby and you've got one of these slingshot devices or a bow and arrow-like device, let me drop it. To easily get your piece of wire high enough in the up in the air, fed with a good antenna tuner, that's going to give you an awful lot of performance. K2KUI, Mel, who's now a silent key, had one of those on the evergreen tree out in front of his house in Far Rockaway, can't even think of the name of the town he's living in now, on the South Shore near Brooklyn. Anyhow,
Manhattan Beach, Dick.
That's it, Manhattan Beach. So in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, I think it's on Doyle Street is where he was. He had one of those at very high performance. Lots of guys he talked to with 100 watts of power thought he was running a California kilowatt. So everyone thinks that a quarter wave ground plane with all its ground plane radios is the right way to get a vertically polarized antenna. Strongly consider the half wave if you've got the capability of doing that. Hell of a lot of performance, a lot less hardware, higher angle of higher phase center, lower angle of takeoff angle, hell of a lot more performance. KD2HUC, wonder if you've got a tall up structure nearby, and if not, you've got the resources to put that tower up there, Steve. KD2HUC, K2RW in the TechNet.
I have some trees that might work. That's definitely something I might play around with. As far as the resources to construct a tower, there's always resources. Getting permission from the wife is, trying to get it through Congress, if you know what I mean. But thanks for the information, Dick. I might play around with that as soon as the weather gets nice, and I'll let you know how I make out. KD2HUC, back to net.
And that vertical half wavelength dipole that I'm describing only has to be electronically a half wavelength. If your tree is not quite a half wavelength tall, you're allowed to put a loading coil in there. You're allowed to put top hat capacitors. You're allowed to zigzag it. You're allowed to helical wind it, as long as it's electronically a half wavelength. Mechanically, it can only be, you could in some cases make it physically a quarter wavelength long, but by way of loading coil in the center, helical winding, top hat capacitors, top and bottom, maybe only on the top, maybe only on the bottom, you can electronically make it a half wavelength long, even though it's a quarter wavelength long, and still get all of this performance. So even if your tree is not tall enough, don't let that be a showstopper. You'd be amazed how many variables, how many knobs you've got on this particular project, Steve. Good luck with that, and let us know. Come back and let us know periodically how that goes. Now we're going to go back to Joe again. W2LYY, K2LIW. Go ahead, Joe.
And I didn't fall asleep this time. Good evening, Dick. W2LYY. Well, my question has to do with antenna systems and counterpoises related to those. Basically, what happens when the counterpoise starts shrinking with relationship to the wavelength? Like you were talking, a ground plane, say like in a mobile operation, becomes the other half of the antenna or the counterpoise of the antenna. As you go higher in frequency, you've got a lot of metal roof, you have a good counterpoise, works fine. You start going lower in frequency, like to 6 meters, 10 meters, 20 meters, 40, 80, and so forth, 160, you can put an antenna on the car to get the antenna to resonate, but what do you do about the other half of which is the counterpoise or the automobile body, for example? I'm just using an automobile for one particular example. As that shrinks, do you start losing the efficiency of your total antenna system? That's the first of these serious questions related to this. Go ahead.
I'm reasonably sure the answer is yes, you lose efficiency. If I started off with a vertical quarter wave mounted on the top of my car on 2 meters of 450, the counterpoise of the metal roof of my car is a beautiful piece of sheet metal, I'm going to get very high performance. As I go to lower and lower frequencies, I now take the other extreme, down to 160 meters, vertical quarter wave antenna on my automobile. That quarter wave is would like to be physically 135 feet tall, but no way in hell am I going to mount that on the car and drive down city streets. So electronically, mechanically, I'm going to shrink it down with all kinds of ways. And the counterpoise is the metal of the car, which at 160 meters is nowhere near enough picofarads between it and Earth. Therefore, there's a lot of RF energy on that car between it and Earth. A lot of that RF energy is going into the Earth, and I'm going to get a lot of heating of that local Earth, and therefore quite a significant loss of efficiency. Also, as I drive over dry desert soil versus wet swampland, the tuning of the antenna will change significantly. I'll have to readjust the tuning and the loading coil, if you know what I mean, quite a bit. Let me drop this. Now, even though it is an extreme case, if you had the resources to make the radiator section on your automobile a vertical, electronically half-wavelength thing, by way of a great big loading coil in the middle, by way of a helical winding, by way of top hat and bottom hat capacitors used and zigzagging and meandering, there's all kinds of ways where you can make the radiator section on your automobile physically very small, electronically a half wavelength. When you do that, the amount of current that flows into your counterpoise, the amount of current that flows into the automobile becomes less and less, because you're feeding the open end of a half wavelength resonator, and it's going to have an impedance of 5,000 or 10,000 ohms. As you make your resonator shorter and shorter physically, but still reestablish resonance electronically, make it half wave, the feed impedance gets higher and higher. So as you make this half wavelength vertical radiator on your automobile, which is probably a 16th of a wavelength long physically, but electronically you've made it a half wavelength, and you're feeding the outer end, you might be feeding at 10,000 ohm impedance. Let me drop. It's going to require a significant L network there to step up the impedance from 50 ohms to 10,000. But the advantage of doing that is high efficiency of the radiator. The energy is bouncing back and forth in that radiator, not flowing into the counterpoise. 1/10 or 1/100 the current is flowing into the sheet metal of the automobile. Therefore, the amount of RF energy between automobile and road is getting smaller and smaller. The efficiency is going up. As long as you can use low enough I squared R loss materials of that resonator, the circulating current in that radiator resonator is going to be very high. Use the right materials, you can now get very little current flowing into the counterpoise, very high efficiency out of that thing. It'll only be a couple of kilohertz wide, but I'll bet you could get 90-some-odd percent efficiency out of that concept. So here we're taking the vertical half-wave resonator concept and pushing it all the way to the logical extreme, all the way down to a small physical structure on an automobile. In my opinion, that is very doable, Joe. I didn't say it's easy, but you can see the huge advantage if you could pull that off. To B2LYY, K2LIW in the tech van.
Quick question, Dick.
Yeah, let me go to Joe first and then back to you, Barry. Go ahead, Joe.
No, let Barry jump in first. I just want to hear what he has to say.
You got it, Barry. Wait for the beep.
Okay, when you said that, I thought of the resonator on my car. If I use a 160-meter resonator on 80 meters, max impedance at the bottom, wouldn't that be what you just said?
The answer is yes. If you've got an electronically quarter-wave resonant 80-meter structure, and now you're feeding it on 160, no, it's the other way around. You're going down to half the frequency. Quarter-wave becomes eighth-wave. You've got to work real hard at 160 meters to make something electronically resonant, electronically a half wave, even though physically it's a 16th of a wave long. But if you put the right loading coil, meandering, helical winding, top hat capacitors, zigzagging, do all of that jazz to...
No. You had it right the first time. I'm using a 160-meter element, but I'm using it on 80 meters.
There's a yes and a no to that. If it was a pure piece of wire, a quarter wavelength long on 160, automatically it becomes a half wavelength long on 80. That's true. However, if you've achieved the quarter wavelength on 160 by way of loading coils and whatever, there it doesn't scale. The fact that you've gone to twice the frequency, you would like to think, yeah, I'm going to have twice the amount of inductive reactants. But like a helical winding and the top hat capacitors, they behave differently. You're going to be very far from second harmonic resonance and half wavelength long at 80 meters. You're in the right direction, but it's not quite that simple. You didn't start off with something that really was mechanically a quarter wavelength long piece of wire on 160. If you did, Yes, it's a half wavelength long on 80 meters, and it's going to work like a charm. But you started off with something electronically, not mechanically, a quarter wave, and therefore it's not going to scale anywhere near linearly as you'd like to. But the concept is right. Back to you, Barry. N2MB, K2IW, the tech man.
It sounds like there are ways to do that, and there would be an advantage in it. Okay, I got to think about that. Back to the N2MB.
Let me show you where the inefficiency happens, where the rubber meets the road, on a quarter wavelength resonator that has too few ground plane radials. A quarter wavelength on, let's say, 80 meters is half of a dipole. The dipole's got 73 ohm impedance, and you're only feeding half of it with reference to a sheet of metal. If the sheet of metal on the ground was infinite and you measured the impedance, you would have half of 72 ohms. You'd have 37 ohms. So the bottom of a quarter wavelength long vertical radiator is 37 ohms. To get high efficiency, the other end of your feed, the end of your coax cable, your transmission line, center conductor is going to that quarter wavelength thing that's 37 ohms to space. The shield is going to something that you and I call ground. And in order for that ground to be a good ground, I'd like it to be less than one-tenth of the 37 ohms. I'd like the ground impedance to the universe to be 3.7 ohms. Oh boy. To try to make your ground plane radial system, your counterpoise, 3.7 ohms to the universe, is going to require 32 ground plane radials, so to speak, or a great big sheet of metal, or a whole bunch of wire laughing and whatever, to get that to be. And even then, with it, that 3.7 ohms, still one-tenth of your current is flowing into that earth, and you're still getting a significant amount of loss compared to what's going on with the dipole, because the dipole is running, the monopole, the quarter wave monopole, is running at a Q of 10, even if it's physically a quarter wavelength long. The signal is bouncing back and forth there at least 10 times. You think you're putting 1 ampere into it from your transmission line. Let me drop it. And the way the bouncing is occurring, and it's all co-phase, you are going to have, with a Q of 10, voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, you're going to have 10 amperes flowing, even though you think you're putting 70 watts into this thing. 70 watts? No. If you're putting 37 watts into it, that would be 37 watts, so you're 1 ampere, 37 volts. You're going to have lots of current, at least 10 times more current than comes out of your transmission line. It's flowing in that antenna structure. So you'd like the impedance of the counterpoise to be even less than a tenth of the impedance of the antenna. So what's really happening is that quarter wave ground plane antennas, you're trying to get an extremely low ground impedance. It takes a whole lot of ground plane radials of significant diameter to do that. Whereas if you made it a half wave structure, and because the half wave structure at high Q, voltage rise at resonance means the impedance at the outer end that you're feeding is going up. That's the right direction. You're going to see a 10,000 ohm impedance. With a 10,000 ohm impedance that you're feeding it from your transmission line, the current that the shield needs to see going back to ground is something becoming minuscule. A simple stake in the ground can do it. So this ground plane radial system and all of its huge requirements of 32 radials to get high impedance, let me drop this. One simple spike in the ground is more than a good enough ground plane radial system if you're feeding the outer end of a half-wave vertical resonator, half-wave vertical radiator. It's very non-traditional. Everybody rejects this the first time they hear it. And when they find out they're going to be feeding a 10,000 ohm impedance, they run scared right away.
Yeah, but that's what I just said. If it's a 160-meter vertical, you're using it on 80 meters, it is a half-wave long.
You've got it. And you're feeding a 10,000 ohm impedance, and it's a... And except for the fact that you need an impedance step-up device, an L network to do it, one simple inductor and one capacitor. The inductor is hand-wound. The capacitor can be made out of sheets of tinfoil, if you know what I mean, with some Teflon in between. So, and that would be a very high transmitting capacitor rated if you don't want to buy it. So the fact that you're feeding a 10,000 ohm impedance, it's way beyond what your antenna tuner can do. But one simple L network can easily handle that for you. But you pick up this huge... improvement in performance because your phase center is higher, the current you're feeding is very low, the amount of current you're feeding into your ground plane radial system is so low that you can get away with murder there, And so it's a hell of a lot better antenna. It's very non-traditional. When I wrote a couple of articles, let me drop this. When I wrote a couple of paragraphs on three or four emails in a row to the doctor is in on QST Magazine on this exact subject a year and a half ago, I could tell I was having a lot of trouble selling the concept because it's so non-traditional. But if people who have done it, and Mel K2KEY did it, and boy, as I said, when he's running 100 watts, lots of guys accused him of running a California kilowatt into the simple green piece of wire hanging from his evergreen tree out in front of his house in Manhattan Beach. N2MB, you probably have some comments on this one, Barry. N2MB, K2LAW.
To use a ham term, I think we're now on the same wavelength. That's what I said in the beginning, and you seem to be disagreeing with me. Okay, so I'm right, you're right, we are right, and why they don't do it on mobile antennas on cars, I'm not sure, because it sounds like a good idea.
If you're running 100 watts and 500 watts from that mobile, and you're feeding a 10,000 ohm impedance, that base voltage is going to be many thousands of volts. You got to be kind of careful how you set up that insulator, that base insulator, and whether or not you allow people to stand there and touch it while you're radiating. You got to be a little bit careful with this thing. But still, when it comes to overall performance of a mobile antenna, I suspect this could have five times the efficiency of some of the mobile antennas that people have built on 80 and 160 meters. So the guy who originally asked this question that got us all going on this one was Steve, KD2, I can't even read my own notes here, HUC.
It proves my point. Sometimes these simple questions have really good answers.
Very non-traditional, darn good answers. And so if you're willing to think out of the box, very few of us are willing to feed the outer end of an extremely high impedance, half wavelength long, single piece of wire with no gap in the center. All of the diagrams in the book have told us a dipole has to be broken in the center and fed there. Absolutely not. Let me drop. You're only coupling energy into this resonator system. For traditional reasons, we always do it in the center. There's nothing magic about the center. You can feed it center, halfway between center and the outer edge, at the outer edge, and have no gap in the wire at all. By the same token, when you're pushing your child on the swing, you can push her at the bottom like you normally do. You could climb up onto the structure and grab onto the leads coming down from the pivot at the top and push and pull on those and couple energy into her and get her swinging very nicely. You don't have to do it putting energy into the system at the bottom. You don't have to feed the dipole in the center. Once you think out of the box and you're willing to feed a 10,000 ohm impedance, you pick up some huge advantages of doing that. KD2HUC, look what you started us on here, Steve. K2IAW in the deck net.
B2GXM with a comment.
GXM after Steve. Go ahead, Steve. Mr. GXM, give us your full call. We only heard 2GXM. And your name, and proceed with your comment. GXM, you got it. K2IAW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW and the group. This is WB2GXM, Rich. What about using a J-pole structure for 80 meters to match the 10,000 ohm impedance at the bottom of the wire? You could use open wire line for the J part, and then you would be able to have 50 ohms somewhere near the bottom of the J. WB2GXM.
On VHF antennas, that's an extremely good approach. On HF frequencies, the way the J-pole works is that the radiator is half wavelength long. The other half of the J-pole is a quarter wavelength long, usually physically a quarter wavelength long. So if you're doing this on 160 meters, for instance, the radiator, if you didn't shrink it down in size, is I think it's 330 feet long for half wavelength, and the impedance matching device is 132 feet long. So At HF frequencies, it becomes physically inconvenient. If I'm going to build a 132-foot-long impedance-matching device on 160 meters, as opposed to simply setting up an L network, one inductor and one capacitor, to take my 50 ohms and step it up to 10,000 ohms, I'd rather take the second approach. I think it's a lot easier, but that's just my opinion, Rich. WB2GXM, good question. K2RIW in the TechNet. Mr. GXM, for any further comments, go ahead, Rich.
Thank you, Dick. Good comment, good point. Nothing else. Back to net. WB2GXM.
Yet sometimes with these crazy think-out-of-the-box antenna systems, you're going to end up with some very wild impedances periodically. 10,000 ohms for the resistive component. And maybe it's got 500 ohms of capacitive reactance also for your particular length and your particular way of helical winding, loading, coiling, whatever. And so those impedances scare the daylights out of people because they're way beyond the usual range of operation of an antenna tuner. Don't let that stop you. You Google the word impedance match plus Berkeley. The Berkeley equation, the Berkeley program, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, Berkeley and University came up with this thing. You go to that website and you tell it what is the starting impedance of your signal generator, probably 50 ohms resistive, 0 ohms reactance. What's the impedance of your load? It might be 10,000 ohms resistance and 5,000 ohms of reactance, capacitive or inductive. You give it that piece of information, the impedance of your source, the impedance of your load, and the frequency you're operating at, and you press go. And in 1 second, out comes 16 answers, 1-6 answers, with the diagrams and the values of the inductors and the capacitor. An L network, an inverted L network, a T network, a pi network, an LT, an L pi, and so on. Choose the one that you like the most. For simply building that network of a wound coil and a capacitor, an L network, to step up the impedance to 50 ohms and cancel the reactance at the same time. Let me drop it. That Berkeley program gives you the bottom line. So the fact that your crazy think-out-of-the-box antenna has a very crazy resistive component and a very crazy reactive component and some crazy combination of them, don't let that be a showstopper. The Berkeley program, in one simple step, will give you the answer. It'll tell you what the Q is, what the bandwidth is, how to build it, so to speak. Well, it's not going to tell you how to build 1.5 microhenries of inductance and 321 picofarads of capacitance. You're going to go to the radio amateur's handbook and find out how many turns out of how many inches of diameter of 14-gauge wire is going to give you that inductance. The early chapters of the radio amateur's handbook will tell you how to do that. But the fact that it's non-traditional shouldn't let that be a stopper. When you can get this huge improvement in performance electronically, as far as radiated signal is concerned, huge improvement in performance as far as the amount of hardware and dollars invested into building this thing, and the fact that you're doing something non-traditional, there's a whole lot of advantage of doing that. When you tell people what you've done and they hear how loud your signal is, they're going to say, gee, I want to do that too, and why hasn't somebody told me about this a long time ago? And the problem is that all the diagrams in the book show us feeding a dipole perfectly parallel to the ground, always fed in the center, and we think there's no other way. There's nothing magic about feeding only in the center. It's a resonant structure. Let me drop. It's a little bit like the great big wheel on a steam engine, a locomotive. A high impedance feed would be the push rod is way out near the perimeter. Well, that's a freight train. But a passenger train can have a low impedance feed where the push rod is much closer to the pivot in the center. So there's nothing magic about the exact diameter at which you feed a flywheel. There's nothing magic about the exact place where you feed a dipole. And once you break through this tradition and you're willing to feed the outer edge at these crazy impedances, boy, is it worth it, in my opinion. The few people who have done it have said it's the best thing since baked bread. Okay, Freddie was next. I hope Freddie is still with us. KB2VBN. How are they treating you out there in Rockaway, Freddie? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick,
you let N2MB come in there, and then you're stealing the thing, like, away. I still have two other parts of the question. Can I continue?
Yes, you can, Joe. Go ahead. To the beat, please.
Okay. In a case of feeding an antenna, I want to give you two particular examples, just see what you got to say about it. In a case of feeding an open wire antenna with coax cable, using the antenna at the antenna center at the other end to match the impedance of the transmitter, where does the counterpoise come from? Because you're not feeding the antenna in the middle at all, you're feeding it at the end. Who knows what the impedance is versus the frequency, but where does the other half of that or the counterpoise actually exist? Is it the coax cable? And if it is the coax cable, if you put chokes on the coax cable to prevent the current from going down the coax cable, you lose that as part of the counterpoise. Again, where would the counterpoise part of the antenna system be?
At first, I'm going to give you an answer of your question with a question. In the case of an NFED ZEP, the so-called Zeppelin antenna, you're on this great big blimp, you're trailing half a mile of wire behind it, you're feeding the outer end of that wire. Where is the counterpoise in that particular case, Joe? On the NFED ZEP, on that Zeppelin? Over to you.
Well, that was going to be my second question, because on an aircraft that has a very limited metallic structure, especially a small private plane, and you try to use HF in a private plane, you can get the antenna to tune the antenna on the aircraft, but the counterpoise shrinks as you go lower in frequency. So that was kind of my second question. I don't know.
Every piece of metal, even that blimp, 5,000 feet in the air, every piece of metal has a certain amount, a real calculatable amount of capacitance to the universe. One of the very interesting puzzle questions that was asked in Electronic Design News magazine a couple of years ago, the man is now a silent key. If you had a long enough piece of wire that went to the moon, another piece of wire that's buried in the earth, and you measure the capacitance between Earth and Moon, how many microfarads would you measure? Now, in order to answer that question, because the Moon is so far away, the fact that it's a spherical object, you can simplify it by making it a 2,200 mile diameter disk, a flat piece of sheet metal, that diameter, and make the Earth 8,000 mile diameter sheet of metal. So you get these two disks with a known area of each and a known spacing between the two, and therefore you can calculate the capacitance. When you do that, you come up with an amount of capacitance that's about 4 to 1 or 10 to 1 too low. At first, it'll drive you crazy. What's going on? The trouble is the Moon has a certain amount of capacitance to the rest of the universe. The Earth has a certain amount of capacitance to the rest of the universe. The Moon is connected to the universe indirectly. The Earth is connected to the universe directly. Things connected to the same thing are connected to each other. So the real capacitance between the Moon is two capacitors, between Earth and Moon is two capacitors. The direct capacitance between the Earth and Moon, the indirect capacitance, both of them connected to the universe. That's the dominant capacitance. It's about four times bigger. Well, by the same token, that blimp has a certain amount of...
Repeater, timeout.
That blimp is a metallic structure that has a certain amount of capacitance to the universe. That capacitor reactance might be, let me pick a number, 50 ohms. Now let's make it 100 ohms. 100 ohms of capacitor reactance, a blimp to universe. The wire that you're feeding for the NFED ZEP might be a 10,000 ohm impedance. Can you stand on a 100 ohm capacitor, 100 ohm capacitor reactance capacitor, and feed enough current into a 10,000 ohm resistive antenna easily? And the fact that you've got a little bit of series capacitance in your counterpoise just shifts the resonance a little bit higher, and you can readjust the impedance match to even correct for that. So when you're feeding a high enough impedance of the outer impedance of a half-wave dipole, the outer end of a half-wave dipole, very minor structures become an extremely good counterpoise that stake in the ground. And that on this portable location, a field day operation, you've shot this half-wavelength piece of wire into a high tree, and you're feeding the bottom of it. you're feeding at 10,000 ohm impedance. The stake in the ground is an extremely good counterpoise. And it's using the local conductivity of that earth from a 10,000 ohm point of view is more than good enough. On the ordinary quarter wave dipole, where you want it to be 3.7 ohms, that's hard to do. But for a half wave dipole, where you're feeding 10,000 ohms, that's easy. Anything can become the counterpoise when your impedance is high enough. Very minor structures. And a purely capacitive counterpoise can be good enough. It just shifts the resonance a little bit. W2LYY, thinking out of the box, Joe. P2IW in the TechNet.
Very good. Good answer. So we all learn some more each time we ask these questions on TechNet. Back to you.
Okay, you said you had two more questions. Did you get a chance to answer or ask both of them? I think you did. I'm double-checking with you, Joe. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, the second one, otherwise you'll yell at me for the beeps not letting the beeps go through. Yeah, the other thing is a friend of mine has an aircraft, a small plane, it's a Baron BE-58. And he runs a 100-watt radio in the thing with a King automatic antenna tuner. And I've done some experiments with him talking for his amateur radio station, which is can be remotely controlled by UHF. We did some interesting experiments with it, and this kind of like proves what I'm talking about, the counterpoise. It seems to work this way. On the higher frequencies, or maybe with propagation, I couldn't tell. But at 25,000 feet, that would yield about a 223-mile line of sight to the Earth at the horizon, at a horizon, about 223 miles approximately. His antenna 90 feet up would give something like 14 miles to the horizon, give or take. So you add those two together, you're a little, you're not much more than 250 or so, okay? 240 or something like that, whatever the heck it is. But what we found out was, on the higher frequency, like him running 20 meters, I could hear him much better and much easier than if he went to 40 meters or 80 meters. In fact, 80 meters at a distance of only half that distance, the signal is just about washed out and just about uncopyable. But as we went to higher frequencies, it seemed like we could make the trip back and forth a lot easier. Back to you.
In the case of 80 meters, particularly in the daytime, D-layer absorption can be huge. The first QSO I ever made as a novice, 1956, on 80-meter CW, on 3.75 or so megahertz, was a guy that was a couple of miles away. I was living in Farmingdale, and I picked up a guy in Amityville, one town away, the adjacent town. He was just barely above my noise because of D-layer absorption. The D-layer absorption at 80 meters can be huge. At 40 meters, it's a hell of a lot less. That's another one of the factors. So not only are you bouncing the signals off the ionosphere in funny ways, not only do you have calculated Earth curvature, line-of-sight conditions. It turns out that the line-of-sight condition on HF frequencies, in many cases, you calculate the amount of signal you're going to get, and what you get in reality is a hell of a lot stronger signal because of the ionospheric bounce. And the direct signal, in many cases, is below the noise because the noise on 80 meters can be huge. It can be an S9 signal. So you're getting plenty of signal there, but it's being covered by noise. And without the ionospheric bounce, you'd never hear him. And you don't get a chance to use the ionospheric bounce on 80 meters because of D-layer absorption at that low frequency in the daytime. These are some of the variables involved there, Joe. W2LYY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, but his plane was only like half the distance, so like I said, and the so you don't believe that the counterpoise of his aircraft being a certain size was a major contributing factor, or was it a minor contributing factor as he went to the lower wavelengths and noticed a huge difference in signal strength, apparent signal strength. And it's pretty much in both directions, coming and going.
Okay, were you getting non-reciprocity? Was the signal in one direction stronger than the signal in the other direction? Is that what I think I heard you saying, Joe? Over to you. Wait for the beeps.
Well, it always would be because he's running at least 10 times the power from his base station apparatus than the plane, so it's at least 10 dB stronger going forward than from the plane back to the his HF station. So yeah, it's always stronger one way or the other.
But because of all this extra altitude and therefore beautiful line of sight, you would think the line of sight signal would dominate and you'd always hear on 80 meters. If 80 meters didn't have a 40 decibel noise figure of the ionosphere, that would be absolutely true. That huge noise figure, because there's a million lightning strokes happening somewhere in the world simultaneously. And all of that atmospheric noise of 40 or 50 dB or 60 dB noise figure on 80 meters, that can dominate over a direct line of sight. With your binoculars and your telescope, you can see that airplane in the air. And therefore, you think you should get a gangbuster signal from him. And you may be getting a signal of 5 microvolts, a huge signal as far as the signal generator is concerned. But when that signal is competing with 40 decibels of noise figure, that signal is below the noise. Only that huge mirror reflection of the ionosphere is giving you a strong enough signal, but in order to get to the ionosphere, you have to go to the through the D layer. And the D layer at daytime on HF frequencies can be hugely absorptive. And therefore, line of sight, common sense, goes down the tubes. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that's what I'm seeming to say. You think it's propagation more than really than anything else. Okay. One last thing, this will probably be another subject for another time. I did try doing some noise tests, like I did on the higher frequencies, like on 6 meters and 10 meters and so forth, and going up higher. I went the other way and tried to do the same thing. And you said the noise floor typically changes 6 dB per octave. I found that not to be completely true, unless I was getting to the localized type of noise that seemed to make a difference in that. But I got a reading on 40 meters on my house antenna, using the antenna tuner to my antenna, making it resonant, and putting a signal into the tap, actually the output of the antenna tuner. And when I went to the lower frequency, half the frequency, then half again, it was not a 6 dB increase in noise. It seemed to be almost constant. It was only a few dB higher. I thought that was kind of funny.
When it comes to impulse noise, and lightning falls into that category, and an awful lot of man-made noise is impulse noise, a general trend is it falls off 6 dB per octave as you go up in frequency. But when it comes to HF frequencies, where you're getting D layer absorption going up and down, ionosphere being above or below maximum usable frequency, on many HF frequencies, on many days of the week, the 6 dB per octave fall off will seem to be violated. And so it's something you got to learn to get used to, because you don't have a simple, one single source, impulse, noise-like thing, like a whole bunch of lightning strikes, and all being propagated the same way as far as D layer and ionosphere is concerned. So, like everything else, there's an awful lot of variables involved here, Joe. So, there's a trend, but there's exceptions to that trend. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Well, knowing that there's signal impulses on the lower frequencies, which will make things like any AM modulation signal seem washed out, I used FM modulation as a test when I did these tests. So I had the same bandwidth going, and I just changed the frequency. And that's where I made my measurements from. Maybe that was not the right way to do it, because you don't normally use FM on the HF frequency, but I just did it, just kind of get a comparison between 40 meters, 80 meters, and 160.
Yeah, the nice thing about a limited discriminator is that the individual spikes get absorbed by that limiter, and they don't come through, per se, out of the loudspeaker. But still, the general amount of noise, broadband noise from a zillion lightning strikes happening simultaneously somewhere in the world, that broadband noise is going to capture your limiter. The fact that you're using FM versus AM doesn't give you a great advantage, if you know what I mean, because it isn't single impulses that we're talking about here. We're talking about a million of them occurring at once. Therefore, it's a very broadband noise, as if it came from a broadband noise generator. And when you build a broadband noise generator and you compare sensitivity of AM reception versus FM limiter discriminator reception. There's no huge advantage of the limiter discriminator in that particular case. Let's see if Freddie is still with us. KB2, VBN, K2RIW. Are you there, Freddie? KB2, VBN, K2RIW. Fred, are you there?
This is KB2, VBN.
KB2, VBN, we finally got to you, Freddie, and glad we didn't put you to sleep. Go right ahead with your question.
Yes, I need an amplifier that works on the marine band, the air frequencies, and the 2 meter 440 band for less than $100 and about 25 to 50 watts. Well, where can I get that at? Does it work? This is KB2 VBN for Rockaway.
Yeah, my first question was going to be, do you need an amplifier for receiver or transmitter? But because you've told us watts, it's obviously transmitter. So you want a broadband amplifier. And there are transistorized amplifiers that cover frequencies like 160 meters through 6 meters inclusive. There are kinds of transistorized amplifiers that cover those kind of frequency ranges. I don't know that anybody makes an inexpensive one. And where would you go to get an amplifier like that? I think there are surplus houses that will sell you things that have been decommissioned that come close to what you're looking for. Anyone on frequency know of a broadband quasi-linear amplifier that Freddie can buy that covers the frequencies of... Okay, who was that? Somebody gave us a word. Give me your call letters, name, and give me the full information. KQRIW listening. Wait for the beeps. Hello? Who was that?
To exchange for the question.
Okay, we're still on Freddie's question. He's trying to buy a broadband inexpensive amplifier covering HF and marine frequencies. Anybody have any suggestions for Freddie? K2RIW in the TechNet. I'd like to believe if he does a search on eBay, there's a chance he'll find something. Anybody with any further suggestions? Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW. Doesn't look like we've got a great answer for you, Freddie. You got a relatively tough, slightly out of the ordinary question, but the normal search engines are worth a try. KB2VBN for any final comments. K2RIW, you got it, Freddie.
KD2KOG with a comment, please.
Sounds like Kilo Bravo 2, Kilo Oscar Golf KOG. Correct me. Give me your full call letters and name, and proceed with your information. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, very good, Dick. Name here is Mike. Call is Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Oscar Golf. And I've been listening to you for about, I'd say about 17 years, maybe a little bit more. And I just wanted to thank you for everything that you do, because you have been pretty much the driving force for me getting into radio and SDRs. And I never had a chance to thank you. And I just wanted to take the time to do so.
I think you said your name is Mike. I can't read my own writing. Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Alpha Golf. Okay, glad you appreciate it. And I've been in the electronic industry for 40 years. Worked on a lot of really nice pieces of electronics at the world's best school, Airborne Instruments Laboratory. Talk to anybody who has worked for the Wheeler Laboratories under Harold Wheeler, or you talk to somebody who has worked for Dr. John Dyer, who was then the president of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And if anybody's been there for a few years, you'll talk to people who they think they were in engineering heaven. They had some nice big contracts with some fancy military electronics that was being developed, and commercial electronics. I worked for the division that made spectrum analyzers. So that's where all this information is coming from. I think it's Mike. KD2KOG. Go ahead, you've appreciated it. K2 Raleigh W and Technic. Not all of it's accurate. We've made some errors. You got it, Mike.
Like I said, I've been listening. I'm 43. I've been into radio since I'm 9. Scanners, like when I was about 15, and I remember being able to. I don't think I was 15 at the time. Might have been a little bit later on. And I would listen to the TechNet, and I was just amazed. And it really, really, you know, sparked my interest in radio and all the things that were going on. And then I procrastinated with getting the license. And I said, you know, one day I'm going to thank this guy, because if it wasn't for him, I probably wouldn't have gotten into it as much as I am. So I just, you know, personally wanted to thank you over the air.
Very fine, Mike. I'm looking at your QRZ.com website. Good-looking shack. Looks like you really got into it. Yeah, electronics, radio electronics, wireless electronics, has a huge amount of capability. The way it's taught in our schools leaves a lot to be desired. The electrical engineering is usually taught by the physics department. They've got a traditional way of doing it that they established right after World War II, when the radiation laboratory series of books were written by McGraw-Hill. And so from a great big memorization of equations, Maxwell's equations point of view, they try to teach you wireless electronics. And that's not the way it's practiced in the real world. You talk to people who have worked at a real company with 10 or 20 years of experience, of apprenticeship. That's where the real wireless information is coming from. And so a lot of modification is required in our schools. You want a real wireless engineer, you probably have to hire a ham radio operator or somebody who has worked for a company like Jasek Laboratory, Wheeler Laboratory, or Airborne Instrument Laboratory. So somebody with 10 or 20 years experience at one of those quasi-schools with a real good apprenticeship, that's where the real information is coming from. Let me drop. And particularly antenna engineering, boy, it's really not taught in our schools at all. You talk to a person who has worked for the antenna engineering department of a good-sized military company, and he's been there for 10 years, you realize he's got a whole bunch of rules of thumb, a whole bunch of little simple equations that work for him. He almost never goes back to the Maxwell's equations to get an answer. He knows, for instance, that you take the width of a horn antenna, the width calculated in wavelengths, divided into 70, and that's the beam width. If, for instance, your horn is 70 wavelengths wide, 70 divided into 70 is 1, it's going to have 1 degree of beam width. If it's 10 wavelengths wide, it's going to have a 7 degree horizontal beam width. It's 90% accurate, good enough. It's a good rule of thumb. Impedance matching, they've got a bunch of rules of thumb. How big the antenna's got to be, a bunch of rules of thumb. What kind of efficiency you get on the antenna. How much forward gain you can get. To get gain out of an antenna, it's got to present a certain amount of area. It takes real estate. 4 pi a over lambda squared is the gain of an antenna. And beam width, gain is a, wait a minute, gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared, yeah. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. So there's some very simple formulas, very simple rules of thumb that people use day in and day out to do the work they do. And the way it's taught in the school is so extremely different. Very rarely can a guy walk out of a good, respected, qualified engineering school with a bachelor, master, or doctorate degree, walk out of the school and go and do antenna engineering. It almost never happens. The school doesn't teach it in a way that gives useful engineering information. They're stuck in the...
Repeater, timeout.
They're stuck in the tradition. They've always done it this way, and they only barely understand the information, and from the way that they teach it, there's a great big memorization of a bunch of equations. And they're afraid to make any change because they don't really understand it. So I don't see improvement happening very fast in the future in this particular area. There are 20 different kinds of wireless products that the American public is using. All those wireless products do not work without a transmitting antenna, a receiving antenna, a reasonable transmitter, a reasonable receiver, and enough bandwidth of all of the above. And so the transmitting antenna, the receiving antenna, the transmitter, the receiver, and how to get the bandwidth out of all of these things is not taught in our schools. So where is that information for all of these products coming from? A very small number of people have got this hidden piece of information, and the company better treat them very well, because if they lose that couple of people who have got this, these little nuggets of information, they lose their capability. You'd be amazed how many companies have a chain of command, a management who doesn't understand the value of the very few antenna engineers they've got. They can't understand why they're being paid so much and treated so royally, and they lay them off, and pretty soon they're out of business. That's a bunch of opinions. Over to you, Mike. KD2KOG. By way of ham radio, you're learning a lot faster electronics, as you can tell. Wireless electronics. K2RIW. You got a mic.
K2RIW, KD2KOG. Dick, I totally agree. But also, you know, nowadays, even with the kids in the school, I wasn't school taught. Everything was self-taught and wanting to learn and just wanting to be a sponge to absorb more. I mean, there's a lot of new hams and a lot of hams that don't know about this net and that there's other, you know, avenues. I mean, you get $1 million education from watching YouTube videos about electronic engineering, RF engineering, and all the above. It's a matter of wanting to learn. If you have the ambition to learn, you'll find somebody that will be that outlet for you. And that's what this TechNet has been for me for a lot of years. And it just hit me to finally thank you. I mean, I've only been a ham for about a year, a little bit less than a year, but I always had it in the back of my head to thank you, and I'm glad I can finally do so. What are you?
Okay, I definitely appreciate that, Mike. My motivation, it's not clear to me as to what I'm doing here for 34 years, 4 hours every single week, 5 or 8,000 hours altogether. This TechNet has been on the air for 4 hours than Johnny Carson is on the air for the 30 years that he was in operation. So it's been a big investment. For people who think I do it only to toot my own horn, there's a degree of that. But I've got this nugget of information. There's a lot more where that came from. I don't have to hold it close to my chest and worry about losing the capability of making any money on this stuff. As I said, there's a lot more where that came from. And so antenna engineering is a black art. So people who make a joke saying that to be an antenna engineer, you have to make a Faustian bargain. You have to make a bargain with the devil. They make jokes about that because the information is so poorly taught in our respected qualified engineering schools. There's a lot of room for improvement. There are professors in engineering schools in New Jersey, for instance, that will sometimes tell their students to listen to the TechNet to find out what real electronic engineering is like in the real world, because it differs from the school. I've watched, let me drop it. As I went through my electrical engineering school, I watched a number of students drop out of electrical engineering because they thought it was too dull, dry, and difficult, and they went into industrial and mechanical engineering. And so they thought that the way they're being acquainted with those subjects in the school is the way it's being be exposed to it in the real world, in the industry like that, and it's not. Night and day. Thank goodness some guys get a summer job where they actually see what the real world is like, very different than the school. And so what's going to be required for the schools to bring themselves up to date, so to speak, I don't know. They're going to have to abandon a tremendous amount of tradition, and they're very reluctant to do that. You take a guy who's going to a good qualified school and he studies computer science and software engineering. He can walk out of the school and get a job earning a good pay doing those things. Not in this particular field. Without that apprenticeship, he can't earn a dollar in this field, in my opinion. I think we've gone down the list. Oh, yes, one more person. N2XJN. Now, Wes, you had a question. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Hey, good evening, N2XJN. Concept of counterpoise. Especially when we talk about monopole antennas. Really, various businesses, say 10-story building, and a counterpoise that's supposed to act as one plate of the capacitor. And we have a plane, airplane, and if there was a use of counterpoise, how that translates versus the distance between the Earth. And then we have antennas in the spacecraft. And to see it.
Yeah, Newton's third law of action and reaction is a good example.